What is the best evidence that the 9/11 attacks constituted a crime of the U.S. state and not a sneak attack by foreign-based terrorists? Are elite elements deliberately promoting claims that the Twin Towers were brought down by controlled demolition in order to protect the true perpetrators? What gains have been achieved by investigators pursuing the physical evidence claims, and what are the prospects for meaningful action for justice? How significant was 9/11 and the truth movement from an independent media perspective? On the season's debut of the Global Research News Hour, and on the occasion of the 15th anniversary of the event which launched the so-called War on Terrorism, we speak to three observers and analysts who offered their perspectives on 9/11, the truth movement, and what gains, if any, have been made. We'll be joined by writer and political activist Mark Rabinowitz, Richard Gage of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and with fellow independent journalist James Corbett of The Corbett Report. On this week's program, 9/11, 15 years later, Part 1, Best Evidence or PSYOP on promoting WTC controlled demolition claims. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 9th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Hillary is so irreparably tainted and unfit to serve, her key strategy is diverting attention from her wrongdoing two ways: bashing Trump beyond customary campaign jousting, and spreading misinformation and big lies about Russia, using the media as press agents to do her dirty work. Neocon Washington Post editors and staff one-sidedly support her, one of many examples of how low U.S. media scoundrels have sunk, transforming themselves into disgraceful laughingstocks. WaPo's latest anti-Russia harangue is claiming a potential covert plot to disrupt November elections. One unnamed U.S. source admitted America's intelligence community has no definitive proof or anything suggesting a Russian plot to manipulate or otherwise disrupt the nation's electoral process. So why is WaPo reporting rubbish, vicious Russia-bashing propaganda, while ignoring how America interferes in numerous elections abroad to assure officials in charge serve its interests? That comes from the article, Fabricated Claims About Russian Covert Plot to Disrupt U.S. Elections, by Stephen Lendman, posted September 8th. Many Kremlin officials preferred Ms. Clinton as a familiar face, while they viewed Mr. Trump as a dark horse. The pro-Western camp within the Kremlin walls, yes, it exists and is quite strong, tried to build bridges with Clinton campaign using Ms. Elizaveta Osetinskaya of RBC as their envoy in Washington. However, the violently anti-Russian propaganda churned by Clinton's campaign and by Hillary personally changed the mood in Moscow. Anti-Russian hysteria of such magnitude has not been seen even at the height of the Cold War in the Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan era, notably Republican politicians. The campaign against Putin's Russia mirrors the campaign against Saddam Hussein's Iraq, and we remember that newspaper columns were followed by columns of tanks. That comes from the article, A Lousy Dancer, Putin's Getting Blamed for All of Hillary's Problems, by Israel Shamir, posted September 8th, originally appearing in the UNZ Review. Although Vladimir Putin and the Russian leadership will try to work with Clinton in a bid to reduce tensions, her close relationship with the neocons and her warmongering attitude would most probably drive the world towards war. In 2014, when referring to the Ukrainian conflict, Killery actually compared Putin to Hitler in one of the most disrespectful and ludicrous remarks that a Western politician has made in recent years. It becomes even more absurd when you consider the fact that the West overthrew the Ukrainian government using and supporting neo-Nazis in the process. A Clinton administration staffed with neocons and war hawks would continue the policy of encircling Russia and of putting missile facilities in Eastern Europe. With tensions between NATO and Russia already great, the last thing the world needs is a Killery administration. That comes from the article, Hillary Clinton, a neocon and a war hawk. Would the world survive a Killery presidency? By Stephen McMillan, posted September 8th, originally appearing at New Eastern Outlook. Last year, high officials from Washington had tried to sabotage the launch of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, AIIB, but failed to do so. In fact, countries that had formerly declared their allegiance to the U.S. government, namely Germany, France, Italy, UK, had, at the end of the day, taken the decision to join the new multilateral lending institution promoted by Beijing. President Barack Obama could not imagine that the AIIB would have got the support of more than 50 countries within a few months. Without a doubt, China is accelerating U.S. decline across the globe. In April 2015, Larry Summers, former Secretary of Treasury under Bill Clinton, declared that the successful call made by the AIIB represented the most dreadful blow to the U.S. hegemony. That comes from the article, China Challenges U.S. Dollar Hegemony, Seeks New Global Financial Order, by Ariel Noyola Rodriguez, posted September 8th. Speaking in Laos, Turnbull's prognostication was grim, quote, as Daesh comes under more and more pressure on the battlefield in Syria and in Iraq, as it is rolled back, as its territory is being taken back, it will resort to terrorist activities outside of the Middle East, unquote. ABC News, September 7th. The Turnbull government has already demonstrated that speculation is a far better milch cow in the making of security policy than evident threat. It promises police state measures, extensive detention periods for those convicted of terrorist charges, even the flimsier ones. Assessing intelligence generally demands dull, hallucinatory-free sobriety, the reactionary posture, all the hallucinatory visions needed. That comes from the article, Islamic State, Lone Wolf Attacks, and Australia, The Value of False Expectations, by Binoy Campmark, posted September 8th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Sunday, September 11th, marks a major milestone, 15 years since the worst terrorist attack on U.S. soil. A movement known today as 9/11 Truth started to take off almost immediately, with figures such as Michelle Chalsadovsky, Michael Rupert, Barry Zwicker, and others gaining prominence as putting forward the counter-narrative that 9/11 was not a sneak attack, but deliberately allowed, if not made, to happen on purpose, so as to provide a pretext for invasions of the Middle East and an intensified police state apparatus at home. The movement gained currency mostly on the internet at first. The movement broke through public consciousness in the wake of the release of the 2005 film Loose Change, which skyrocketed to 4 million views within 4 months and started to gain major media exposure on U.S. and European television stations. Among the claims brought forward as definitive proof the attacks were fabricated are evidence of controlled demolition of the Twin Towers, as well as the sudden collapse in the late afternoon of September 11th of World Trade Center Building 7, which was not hit by an airplane. The movement has unfortunately been marginalized in mainstream media and political consciousness, reducing it to virtual ineffectiveness as a tool against state oppression and militarism. There have been figures, however, who embrace the false flag explanation of the attacks but reject the cold, controlled demolition thesis, both for evidential and for strategic reasons. One of these is Mark Rabinowitz. Mark Rabinowitz has been a writer, political activist, ecological campaigner, and permaculture practitioner for over three decades. He's the author of Peak Choice, Cooperation or Collapse, An Uncensored Guide to Earth, Energy, and Money. He is also publisher of a fascinating website, oilempire.us, a political map to connect the dots between resource wars, ecological limits, and deep state events like 9/11 and the JFK assassination. He joins us from Eugene, Oregon. Mark Rabinowitz, welcome back to the Global Research NewsHour.
Thanks again for the invitation.
The controlled demolition hypothesis seems to be such a dominant aspect of 9/11 truth these days. A lot of people point in particular to the collapse of Building 7 as the smoking gun. The collapse was symmetrical. It looked like a controlled demolition. It was not hit by an airplane. Fires have never caused a steel frame skyscraper to collapse like this. And, you know, you're probably familiar with some of the key talking points there. So I'm wondering if you could, I mean, I want to get into the strategic arguments in a minute, but in terms of the evidentiary analysis, what for you are the most important arguments that refute the controlled demolition argument, if you could put that, you know, relatively briefly?
Well, I think those who allowed 9/11 to happen probably understood that flying planes into the towers would bring the towers down. It's fortunate, in a way, that the towers stood up long enough to allow most of the people below the impacts to escape with their lives. If the towers had collapsed on impact, 9/11 would have been even worse than it was. In terms of Building 7, it certainly looks like a demolition, but the one of the towers gouged a multi-story hole on the side of it, which the firefighters watched all afternoon and became concerned that the building was going to come down. They put transits, a form of survey equipment, on the towers and Building 7 and watched them buckle and lean before they collapsed, which is not demolition. Now, you mentioned Mike Rupert in your introduction. He published from the Wilderness website and Crossing the Rubicon, which is one of the very best books on the evidentiary details of 9/11. And he and his effort, which I wrote for a couple times, did not touch at all the issue of demolitions or alleged claims that missiles were flown into the buildings, but instead looked at how warnings that the attacks were about to happen were deliberately suppressed at the highest levels of the Bush-Cheney administration, and how war game exercises simulating the actual events were used to distract and confuse the air defenses until the attacks had concluded. From an evidentiary standpoint, it would make more sense to put the perpetrators and enablers on the defensive rather than a ragtag group of investigators on the Internet who lack subpoena power, who lack really any evidentiary expertise on this in many cases, and instead focus on the deliberate lies of the government and the 9/11 Commission about why the attacks were allowed to happen and why rank-and-file agents at the FBI and CIA were actually blocked from stopping the attacks.
So I guess, I mean, you're saying that even if the claims of controlled demolition turned out to be true and it there was, you know, weightier evidence, you and Rupert and others would still recommend against pursuing that line of argument as part of a strategy to confront the crime?
Well, first, the firefighters who were there are pretty clear that they don't believe this at all. I wasn't there. They were. They measured the buildings buckling and leaning. Most of the truthers did not. But arguing over that type of evidence reminds me of people who want to spend their time looking at the JFK assassination by focusing on how many bullets were fired and from what direction, when the real issue is why, not how. You can get lost in microanalyzing the evidence, and some people with the JFK research have done that for decades, and it has still not changed U.S. militaristic policy towards the type of peaceful transition that JFK was promoting. So if you want to spend your time focusing on the micro details of how the buildings collapsed, you know, I'm afraid that's going to be the same thing as with JFK. People will spend the next couple decades doing this, and meanwhile, we'll have endless warfare that makes the whole topic moot.
Let's stay with that JFK parallel for a second. I mean, could you talk more about how the investigation itself was, I mean, derailed? You're saying that there was too much of a focus on the how and not the why, right?
Well, the early critics of the Warren Commission focused a lot on debunking the claim that three bullets were fired at John Kennedy. And I don't mean to rehash that. I assume most of your listeners know that is a lie. But the real issue is, what was Kennedy trying to do that got him removed from office? He was trying to turn off the Cold War. He had signed an order to withdraw U.S. troops from Vietnam. He was trying to turn off the nuclear arms race. And then, if you really want to get into it, there were other policies in Africa and Asia that he was trying to shift. I mean, what would the world be today if the Cold War had ended around 1965, as he and Khrushchev were trying to accomplish? How would we have used the resources for endless war for our collective survival as a species, as a civilization? That's the real issue with JFK, not whether it was four bullets or seven bullets that were fired in Dealey Plaza, or which direction they came from. As John Judge, one of the best JFK researchers, said, when he was asked which direction the bullets came from, he said they came from Washington.
Now, in both cases, though, it does seem as if the public's imagination is triggered more by the footage of Kennedy being shot from the front rather than from the back, where Lee Harvey Oswald was firing, and similarly, this collapse of World Trade Center 7, that seems to grab people's attention more than these details, about who might have had the motive and those sorts of arguments. So I don't know, is that the fact that there seems to be an easier ability to reach a wider audience by focusing on those sorts of more dramatic photographic and sorts of arguments than with these sorts of the nitty gritty types of points that you're raising? That's something that I guess the deep state counts on.
Well, you are doing radio and not television, and television is more popular in our culture than radio. But the difference between the collapse of the towers and the Zapruder film showing Kennedy being shot from the front is there's absolutely no doubt whatsoever about the fact that Kennedy was shot from the front, that Lee Harvey Oswald wasn't firing at him, and that more than three bullets were fired. Whereas with the collapse of the towers, that's a much more complex topic, and in any evidentiary legal issue, the judge will usually give the state's expert witnesses the benefit of the doubt. Whether it's on this type of issue or something smaller, the official story starts off ahead of any challenger. And from a legal standpoint, let alone a factual standpoint, you have to have ironclad proof, not speculation. And meanwhile, we have the failure to do standard operating procedure when we heard that the attacks were underway for the government. You have 15 countries, if not more, that warned the Cheney White House that the attacks were about to happen. You have rank-and-file agents in the federal government who tried to stop it. You have a massive cover-up afterward. And once you have these established, which we had established pretty soon after the attack, the rest is detail.
So yeah, you're getting at what you consider the best evidence that could be brought forward, and that has to do with the suppression of warnings. Maybe you should just give us a couple of examples when you're talking about government operatives and key officials and their ability to block and sabotage normal operating procedures, which would have and should have prevented the attacks. Just speak to the solidity of those claims.
Well, my favorite resource for this is called the Complete 9/11 Timeline, which was compiled by a group of people, including Paul Thompson, who was one of the earliest researchers. And it goes into more detail on this than almost anybody would ever want. A couple of my favorite nuggets is you had the FBI agents in Minnesota who arrested one of the potential hijackers a couple of weeks before the attacks. Mr. Moussaoui was his name. And he was arrested at the flight school that he was training at. And the flight school had actually called the FBI, warning that they were concerned that he wanted to fly a plane into the World Trade Center. So he was arrested. He was a French national. And the French secret police said, oh, yeah, they knew him, and he was bad news, and he'd been to Afghanistan and all the rest. The FBI agents in the field tried to get a warrant to look at his computer and were overruled by senior management in Washington. After the attacks, they looked at his computer and found all sorts of incriminating material. And if they had looked at the computer beforehand, the attacks could not have happened. That's obstruction of justice. That's a felony in the United States. And it was never, not so much investigated, but there needs to be accountability. One of the officials who was involved in suppressing that got a pay increase. And the Colleen Rowley, one of the agents in the field, she wasn't at the FBI long after that, even though she got a lot of public praise for trying to do her job. Now, for the FBI to be concerned about this, not getting a warrant for someone who wants to commit mass murder, you know, that's not their normal behavior. That's obstruction. You had foreign countries, including most of America's allies, provide warnings, some of them very specific, about who, what, where the attacks were going to be. Some of the warnings were very specific. Some were less so. There are probably other warnings that have not been made public. Most of them were completely ignored in the 9/11 Commission.
Now, I want to get to, there's an article you sent me. It was written by Emmanuel Sferios on the occasion of the fifth anniversary of 9/11. And just an excerpt from the intro. One lesson the shadow government has learned over the last 40 years is that the best way to defeat your opposition is to become your opposition. And like many of those phony socialist and anti-war groups on college campuses that suck rebellious student energy and dissipate it ineffectively, preventing the formation of a legitimate, effective opposition, So have they taken over a large part of the 9/11 truth movement itself, channeling new skeptics and old into endless debates about physical evidence and other ineffective actions. I'm wondering if you could tell us, Mark, are there any indications in your mind that the diversion of the investigation towards controlled demolition theories and other physical evidence claims is part of a deliberate psychological operation and not simply an unfortunate happenstance by naive investigators?
Well, it's a mix of the two. My favorite example of that is actually the claim that a missile was fired at the Pentagon and not actually Flight 77. This claim was first made public by U.S. War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld about a month after the attacks. And I don't think anyone needs to question what Donald Rumsfeld's motivations were, that he was not a trustworthy individual, to put it politely. Now, that does not mean that everyone who has echoed this is doing it maliciously. When I first looked at the claim, I found it intriguing and almost believed it, and then realized, oh, this is not actually correct. But as a hoax, it had a lot of traction for discrediting the idea of foreknowledge in the Washington, D.C. area, since hundreds of people saw the plane crash and hundreds more picked rubble and luggage and bodies out of the site. In the first couple of years of the 9/11 truth movement, there was very little focus on demolition as a primary claim. Most of the focus was on the suppressed warnings, the stand down of the air defense, and the war games that simulated the actual events. I mean, why was the Central Intelligence Agency doing a plane into building exercise near Dulles Airport at one of the main intelligence agency headquarters, the National Reconnaissance Office, which runs the spy satellites? That is not in the 9/11 Commission report. It was in the media, it was in the media, in the Associated Press, but it wasn't in the 9/11 Commission report. It's who scheduled a plane into building exercise at the exact time that the planes turned around toward their targets. That deserves an investigation. It certainly deserves attention. There's also the issue of what's called ALEC Station, A-L-E-C. ALEC Station was the CIA's office that was set up to stop bin Laden and his group. And they refused to share their information about the hijackers being in the country with the FBI, the Domestic Intelligence Agency of the United States. Again, that was also not in the 9/11 Commission report. If we ever had a real investigation, which doesn't seem likely, ALEC Station would be a good place to start.
So I just only have a couple more minutes left. On the occasion of this 15th anniversary of 9/11, there's a presidential election looming in a couple of months. I'm wondering what you would suggest we make of all of this conjecture as the human family forges ahead into an uncertain future where perhaps more deep state events loom.
It would be nice to think that 9/11 would be the last deep crime of state. But unfortunately, as long as the distractions and diversions can keep people preoccupied, as long as most people don't want to see how these things work, it's likely we will continue to have more and more of these types of events. And the real goal is not to have necessarily a new investigation, since that seems about as likely as a new investigation of the JFK assassination, but to be able to transform the effort for world war towards global peace. We're at peak oil, we're at climate change, overpopulation, increasing tension all over the world. And the real issue is how to convert the war machines, not just of the United States, but we're number one for that, towards survival for humanity and the biosphere. Because if we don't do that, we're likely to collapse civilization. And I think subconsciously, we all know that. And one of the aspects of 9/11 was to ensure endless warfare, and it's been very effective, unfortunately.
Mark Rabinowitz, thank you very much. Mark Rabinowitz has been a writer, political activist, ecological campaigner, and permaculture practitioner. He's the author of Peak Choice, Cooperation or Collapse, An Uncensored Guide to Earth, Energy, and Money. His website is oilempire.us. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Richard Gage, AIA, is a San Francisco Bay Area architect and member of the American Institute of Architects. He is the founding member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. AE911truth.org now registers 2,620 architects and engineers, all demanding a new investigation into the destruction of all three WTC high-rises on 9/11. Richard Gage, it's a pleasure to have you back on the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you, Michael. It's my honor.
Richard, we have introduced you before in detail about the failures of the National Institute on Standards and Technology report to adequately explain the collapses. I was hoping you could just give us a very, very brief recap. So I'm just going to maybe appeal not only to your expertise as an architect with 28 years of experience in the field and who's researched this the attacks thoroughly, but also I'll be calling on your abilities as an auctioneer. Can you do it maybe 2 minutes or less? Some of the main points that challenge the official narrative?
Well, yes, there is all of this evidence that NIST has not included in the reports. First of all, regarding the World Trade Center Building 7, while they were forced into acknowledging that this third tower that collapsed on 9/11 collapsed at free fall acceleration, they were embarrassed publicly into this, but they do not acknowledge the implications of that or the implications of the videos that show that it came down exactly like a classic controlled demolition. In fact, at free fall and in under 7 seconds. This symmetrical freefall collapse can only happen if all 80 columns are removed from this building at once. That's the only way it happens. And, of course, that only happens by explosive demolition, like the old hotels, for instance, in Las Vegas. And there's evidence of incendiaries, molten iron, molten steel, documented by official sources, by FEMA, which that metallurgical examination, which proves incendiary, was removed from the final report that came out by NIST 7 years later that blames the collapse of this building, this 47-story steel frame building, by normal office fires. And so, of course, just on the face of it, it's absurd. And every architect and engineer we talk to, 2,700 of them, now have signed our petition demanding a new investigation. And so that's the nutshell version for Building 7. With respect to the Twin Towers, we have evidence of incendiaries not only in the pools of molten iron underneath in the basements of both Twin Towers, but in the billions of iron microspheres found by the USGS and R.J. Lee, an environmental consulting firm, throughout the World Trade Center dust. And this is absolutely a direct explanation by way of incendiaries, as well as the explosive demolition of these buildings, hurling 4-ton structural steel sections laterally in every direction, landing 600 feet away, 60 miles an hour. These sections are shot out of the towers, trailing thick white smoke clouds, which is also indicative of thermite, which would have to have been removing the core columns as well in order to bring each of these buildings symmetrically down in under 12 seconds, shattering the structural steel frames of each of them completely from top to bottom.
Hmm. Okay, well, that's very good. I just wanted to bring up a couple of points because my other guest, who's has some skepticism about the controlled demolition hypothesis, brings up a point, and I'm not sure this is something that you've acknowledged, but there were reports from firefighters on the scene who claimed to have seen buckling on the southwest corner between floors 10 and 13 early on, and that there was tremendous damage from falling debris from the North Tower, which hit the south face of World Trade Center 7, Tower 7. And, of course, there was a gaping 20-story hole on there and heavy fires. And based on that and the creaking noises and stuff from named firefighters, they were on the scene saying, we've got to evacuate the area. And they were anticipating a collapse and that they started to clear the area around 4:30, just before the building did collapse. So I'm just wondering if you are familiar with those details, and if that's maybe if that doesn't somehow contradict or any of the observations that you've raised.
No, none of those points contradict the evidence. The evidence. Those points do not show how this building could possibly have fallen. after witnesses hear explosions. They describe the building, and then we can see the building coming down in the videos, symmetrically, straight down, uniformly. So any buckling on the side on the 11th floor would have been an argument in favor of this building falling over, not straight down. That takes all 82 columns at once being removed from this building in order for it to fall straight down. In fact, the penthouse, main penthouse and screen wall falls directly straight down a half a second prior to the overall building, indicating that those core columns were removed all at once. And that's irrelevant then as to what damage from the North Tower may or may not have caused it. NIST even says, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, who was tasked by Congress with explaining these collapses, they acknowledge that the damage from the North Tower was insignificant. They acknowledge that diesel fuel, which was another myth out there, was not a factor in this building's collapse. It came down, they say, due to normal office fires. Normal office fires have never brought down a skyscraper in the 100-year history of skyscrapers and over 100 examples of very hot, large, and long-lasting fires, which have never brought one down. But controlled demolition has, in the exact manner as it did come down. And there's evidence of incendiaries, pools of molten iron, seen by the first responders, the structural engineer himself, Leslie Robertson, who suggests that there was a river of molten steel. Well, normal office fires can't create that. And this building was not hit by a plane. This is the third tower that came down.
Well, if you're arguing that explosives only explosives could have generated the heat that would have not only created the molten metal, I mean, I don't know if it's aluminum or some other sort of substance, but that would have generated the heat necessary. But if that's the case, then these explosives would have had to have been planted like before the planes hit them, right?
Clearly, this takes months with dozens of operatives in an undercover operation. Perhaps at the time that ACE Elevator, who came out of nowhere to secure this largest elevator modernization in the world, and were in the Twin Towers with 85 employees when the planes hit the towers. So we certainly want an investigation of ACE Elevator. We certainly want an investigation of the security company, Stratasec, of Securicom, who had the contract for the security up until the day of 9/11, when their contract actually ended.
So if these explosives were planted in the building before the planes hit them, why wouldn't the plane crashes have set them off? I mean, these planes would have generated a lot of heat. You know, kinetic energy turns into heat energy, and why wouldn't that have set off those explosives?
I'm sure they did. There's probably fail safes that would keep such explosions or explosives from going off all throughout the building, because as we know that. The chain of explosions, which were heard by hundreds of witnesses, that did start the collapse of this building, happened 50 minutes to 90 minutes after the first plane hit the tower. So I'm sure there was some damage to those locally produced explosives, but that doesn't invalidate any of the evidence.
Okay.
Which we found. In fact, there's evidence of very high-tech nanothermite incendiaries found in all the World Trade Center dust samples by an independent team of scientists led by Niels Harrit in Copenhagen. Red-gray chips, up to 10 tons of them by extrapolation, and four independently collected samples, they find that this is a very high-tech form of nanothermite developed only by the most sophisticated advanced defense contracting laboratories. That's in a peer-reviewed paper, the Bentham Open Chemical Physics Journal, called Thermitic Materials in the World Trade Center Dust. It shouldn't be there.
Okay, Richard, you've done a tremendous amount. Like, it's been a decade, as I said at the outset, since your eyes were opened, as it were. So I'm wondering, beyond this awareness raising with the tours and the videos and the media appearances, What in practical terms have you and other people in this movement done in the last 10 years to confront the authorities that, as you're saying, had the means, motive, and opportunity to make it happen on purpose?
Well, early on, we submitted requests for a correction to NIST with their fraudulent building reports for all three towers, forcing them to reply and say that, oh, we found no evidence for explosives. But then they acknowledge in writing, due to a response to a FOIA request, that they never looked for evidence of explosives or incendiaries, after lying and saying that, implying that they never, that they did look for them earlier. I forgot what I was going to say next.
Okay. Well, could you talk about some of the other efforts that you've taken in order to confront the powers that be?
Yeah. Thanks. Sorry. We've gone to. We're in a lawsuit against NIST as well. Right now, to get them to release more information, we've gone we've given our DVD and our petition when we reached 1,000 and then 2,000 members calling for a new investigation, architects and engineers, to every member of Congress. We've gone to all of the media again and again on an annual basis. We've gone to 10 different annual and regional conferences of the American Institute of Architects and the Structural Engineering Society, and had booths where we show the evidence. We show Building 7 come down. We say, did you look at this? Did you know about this third tower? They say no. We say, well, what does it look like to you? They say controlled demolition. I'm talking hundreds and hundreds and by now thousands of architects and engineers who we confronted directly one-on-one at these events. And they say, yeah, it's a controlled demolition. And we go, did you know it came down on 9/11? No, no way. And so they didn't know about the third worst structural failure in modern history. That is World Trade Center Building 7. We educate them about it. They end up signing our petition. And we're going to have 1,000 co-sponsors for a resolution at the annual business meeting on the floor of the American Institute of Architects' next convention in Orlando, calling upon the AIA to call for a new investigation.
So if you're talking talking about a new investigation, like who there's already been an investigation into 9/11, which is, you know, ipso facto flawed, but there it seems to me that because 9/11 was 15 years ago, you know, most university-aged students today were barely out of diapers when 9/11 happened. And so I'm wondering if we couldn't get an authentic investigation when the wound was fresh, what are the chances we're going to be able to pressure such an investigation now when there's so many other, you know, things happening on the world scene with ISIS and, you know, the other climate change and some of the other things that are pressing down?
Awareness is growing among the American people in particular. Half the people now almost are aware of Building 7. I don't know why the architects and engineers aren't, but more people are becoming aware of it because of the work of the millions in the 9/11 grassroots movement. There's increasing pressure. So it's building. It's important. It's not a history. 15 years later, we're still governed, impacted severely by the $4.5 trillion global war on terror, which started as a result of 9/11. If there's any question about 9/11, we have to uncover it, the truth about what really happened on that day. Because obviously the implications of the controlled demolition of this building, these buildings are deep and severe and impact all of us. And I can understand why there's a reluctance to look at it even 15 years later. But we have to, and I believe we are making progress. And this conference that we're putting on in New York at the Cooper Union is direct evidence of that. We have 800 seats in the Cooper Union on September 10th and 11th, Saturday and Sunday, and we have a whole a dozen attorneys, including one of the most famous public advocates attorneys, Daniel Sheehan, with the Pentagon Papers, the Iran-Contra affair, the Karen Silkwood case. He's coming out on 9/11. He's talking about how to get this evidence into the court system, as is Judge Ferdinando Impassimato, the honorary president of the Supreme Court of Italy. He's coming and talking about how to get this evidence into the world court system. William Pepper, who's a famous attorney for the Martin Luther King case and the killing of Robert Kennedy, that case, he's emceeing the whole event on Sunday, which is a legal effort in the pursuit of justice. On Saturday, Mark Crispin Miller, famous journalist, is emceeing the whole affair with guest speakers such as Wayne Mattson and J. Michael Springman, who expose the roots of ISIS and the deep state. We have an incredible conference coming up, which is going to launch this new Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry onto the 9/11 Truth Movement scene, as well as the Truth Action Project, or TAP, 9/11 TAP, an effort to organize locally hundreds of grassroots organizations dedicated to getting the truth out about 9/11 and impacting Congress and the media.
Conventional wisdom says that you turn to mainstream media to get your information. How have you been, have you seen any kind of, how is the trajectory in terms of the mainstream media coverage of this issue? Are you satisfied that there's any progress, or are things becoming more subverted? How do you gauge the way mainstream media has progressed on capturing this situation?
There seems to be some progress. We have a 45-minute interview on C-SPAN's Washington Journal, which became their number one viewed video ever. And yet, on the dark side, we have not been invited back for some reason. These people get talked to. We've learned that 90% of the mainstream media is owned by just six corporations. We've learned that those six corporations are controlled in turn by boards of directorates that are cross-linked to those corporations in the arms industry, the oil industry, the banking industry, the insurance industry. That's who controls our media. So we're certainly not surprised to be censored. The truth about 9/11 and the truth about many other important topics in our society today.
Richard Gage, appreciate your coming on the show with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
Richard Gage, AIA, is the founding member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and as you just mentioned, he's speaking at the Justice in Focus event happening this September 10th and 11th in New York City. For details, please visit www.911justiceinfocus.org. James Corbett is the host and producer of The Corbett Report, an independent, listener-supported alternative news source which operates on the principle of open-source intelligence and provides podcasts, interviews, articles, and videos about groundbreaking news and analysis on topics ranging from 9/11 and false flag terror to eugenics to the central bank fraud to geopolitics and more. He joins us now from Japan, where he is based. So thank you very much for joining us, James Corbett.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Now, for myself, we're at it's the 15th anniversary of 9/11, and for me, my involvement in independent media, I would say, largely began with 9/11 because I saw so many of these, through my investigations on the internet, I saw so much that was just not being discussed, even in a lot of the conventional alternative media, and so I just felt compelled to go out and distribute the things that I was finding, leaflets and DVDs and even hosting a couple of film screenings at a public theater. And that led me into becoming a broadcaster at my community radio station and ultimately the podcasts I do with Global Research. And I was just curious to know, because you're doing a lot of this very beyond the pale reporting on 9/11 and all these other subjects. I'm wondering what role 9/11 in particular had as an influence to your own work.
Well, I think my story sounds very similar to yours in that I was also, I think, drawn to the idea of alternative media and what could be accomplished through the independent independence offered by the internet because of the types of things that were not being reported on. 9/11 was the foundational event, but on a number of other issues. But certainly 9/11 was a core event for me. It was the first one that I really started researching on my own and that I started to get into and started to notice the discrepancies between what was being portrayed in the mainstream media and even, as you say, a lot of the conventional alternative media and what I was encountering online, the information I was able to dig up on, again, documentable, verifiable information about Osama bin Laden and the CIA in the 1980s or the Operation Northwoods plan or things like that, that start to ring alarm bells when it comes to 9/11 and was not being portrayed anywhere. And the internet offered that outlet through which ordinary people can reach out to tens, hundreds, thousands, occasionally millions of people around the world. It is truly a phenomenal time to be alive in that respect. So I knew I was compelled to do something. And within a few months, really, of starting along the investigative trail, I was already thinking about starting a website, something that I had never even contemplated before in my life.
Yeah, myself as well. I had not really thought seriously about getting into broadcasting or journalism until I went onto the internet and saw, you know, this all of these very well-defended positions that were being put out by superior writers. I mean, people like Michelle Chosadovsky, for example. James, what would you say then would have been the impact of 9/11 and 9/11 truth on media at large? You know, not just mainstream, but alternative media. Have we seen any sorts of impact or on the way people consume media?
I think that would come down more to the individual level. Certainly when we look at the mainstream media and how it has been affected by 9/11 or 9/11 truth, I think the only thing that we can conclude is that 9/11 truth is a perfect gateway for people who don't see the control of the media or how the media discourse is very tightly narrowed down to a very well-defined spectrum of allowable opinion. People who have difficulty seeing that can see it very clearly on issues like 9/11, especially when they've looked into various aspects of 9/11 truth and found some of the stunning, really, truly remarkable information that's out there that one really has to dig around on the internet, usually through alternative independent media, in order to find. And I think that shows in a quite crystal clear manner that this is certainly not something that's going to be televised. The revolution will not be televised, as they say. So I think that's the perspective we have for the mainstream media. And as you say, the conventional foundation-funded alternative media, in quotation marks, that won't go near subjects like this or tend to denigrate them along with the MSM, I think also shows that there is a large degree of control of allowable opinion, even within the so-called dissenting voices out there, something that should not be unfamiliar to people, for example, who are familiar with Noam Chomsky's idea of manufacturing dissent and allowing certain acceptable forms of critique in order to obscure the real critique. And interestingly enough, of course, Noam Chomsky is another one of those people who say, don't look into 9/11, it's not worth your time. Make of that what you will. But I think that this issue exposes what can be seen as real independent media versus establishment media of various sorts, even ones that are conventionally thought of as alternative media. And so we see that 9/11 truth has ultimately flowered and reached fruition as an internet-based movement primarily. And that's interesting because it may be the first real independent alternative media movement that has arisen, did arise around this 9/11 truth issue. And that speaks to the at least potential power of alternative and independent media, which has, I think, truly influenced the public consciousness on events like these, where when I was starting 10 years ago, the idea of false flag terrorism, let alone the concept, was completely foreign to the vast majority of the population. The most people, when confronted with the idea, would say, why would the government attack itself? We've reached the point where not only is it now a much more well understood phenomenon, but even mainstream media has to, in the wake of many of these events that are coming along, has to question is this a false flag event? And of course, they will usually answer no. But at least that idea is now au courant. And I noticed that in the wake of the the Boston Marathon bombing, for example, it was a Yahoo News headline, "Was the Boston Marathon bombing a false flag event?" That's a pretty remarkable shift in public consciousness. And I think that has been accomplished solely and specifically through this internet-based movement.
You've also got a new series of videos coming out just over the past week, I've noticed. I think there's four. It's called 9/11 Suspects. And I was wondering if you could maybe give us a bit of a brief breakdown of who these people are and why they're there. Because as far as I can tell, they don't look like the photographs of the hijackers that I've seen.
Certainly not. The concept behind this series is that these are not people that I think are the kingpins or masterminds behind 9/11, but people who I think any real criminal investigation of what occurred on 9/11 would begin with, would start looking at these people and the information that they were privy to and or that they were involved in, the events that they were involved in, and how that relates to what was happening on 9/11. So, for example, as a fairly non-controversial example, Christine Todd Whitman, who was the EPA administrator on 9/11, who in the days and weeks following the events of September 11th repeatedly issued assurances that the air was safe to breathe in Lower Manhattan. It's okay. You don't need a respirator. To be fair, the EPA did say that first responders on the pile, on the actual ground zero designated area, should wear respirators. But other than that, they actually discouraged people in Lower Manhattan generally from wearing respirators and encouraged people to return to work. Encouragement that we now know is having health effects on a lot of people, of course, first responders, but also residents of Manhattan and Brooklyn, who ended up trying to sue Christine Todd Whitman. And that court case proceeded in 2006 when a federal district court judge ruled that Christine Todd Whitman and the EPA's reassurances actually contributed to the danger, those reassurances were conscience shocking. But that was overturned a couple of years later by a panel of judges that decided that her federal immunity kicked in here, that she couldn't be prosecuted for this. So that's an example that probably a lot of people have heard of in some respect or other, the air is safe to breathe lie that is still killing first responders and others who are dying of the 9/11 cancers. But beyond that, people like Rudy Giuliani, who of course was mayor of on 9/11 and presided over the destruction of the crime scene. He was also given some type of warning about the collapse of the buildings before the buildings collapsed, a warning that was not passed on to the first responders. Of course, over 300 firefighters dying in the collapses of those buildings. We have people like Philip Zelikow, the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, who controlled that commission from top to bottom in terms of everything, the scope of investigation, the people to be questioned, the lines of question to be given them, the shape and outcome of the final report. And this man was deeply tied into the Bush administration, having co-authored a book with Condoleezza Rice and been on the president's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, deeply tied into the Bush administration that he was supposedly investigating. So certainly someone that you would look into in terms of the cover-up of 9/11. People like Robert Baer, a career intelligence officer with the CIA, who is well-known. He appears on TV and talking about intelligence matters. He has a Time magazine column about intelligence matters, who a few years ago said, "I know the guy who cashed out the day before 9/11. He may have been lying about that, but at any rate, I think that would be worthy of further investigation. Strangely enough, he's never been questioned about those comments. So these are the types of people that I think a real criminal investigation of 9/11 would really start to look into. And that's the impetus behind the 9/11 suspect series.
With more to come, no doubt. James Corbett, I want to thank you very much for joining us and sharing these thoughts with us on this pivotal anniversary.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with James Corbett. He is the producer and host of The Corbett Report. You can find his videos at corbettreport.com and on the Corbett Report YouTube channel. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.